time for a deep dive into the one issue that matters most in a capitalist democracy, money. This is Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money, a joint production of the Maggie Dawn Show and the Patriotic Millionaires.
It's Maggie and the Millionaires talking money, 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 because it's always about the money. I am really excited to be joined today by Bob Lord, Senior Vice President for Tax Policy at the Patriotic Millionaires, as well as Scott Ellis, one of the founding board members of the Excessive Wealth Disorder Institute, himself a Patriotic Millionaire. Welcome back to the show, gentlemen. I'm so excited to have you because I love talking about the Supreme Court. It is so important that people understand that the court has been moving the goalpost quite a bit for the middle class.
Thanks, Maggie. I find it a little painful to talk about the Supreme Court, but it is important.
I guess I mean that love in sort of like air quotes. It's important to talk about the Supreme Court. As a legal nerd, I love tearing apart what are, in my opinion, some of the most porous and ill-reasoned decisions that we have seen. I think some of the court's decisions are going to go down in that same vein of Plessy versus Ferguson under the harsh, blaring light of historical review. But Bob and Scott, we wanted to talk specifically about corruption at the Supreme Court and one particular case. I want to start with you, Bob. As a tax lawyer for over 30 years, how bad is the current level of corruption at the Supreme Court, especially the influence of basically this small cadre of billionaires? And why does that matter for average people?
Well, in my estimation, it's a horrible level of corruption. You have one individual, Leonard Leo, who I don't think he founded the Federalist Society, but he made it what it is. And he's kind of acted as a coordinator between the court and a handful of billionaires, led by Harlan Crow and a couple others. Paul Singer is another one. And they've showered these couple justices with gifts. Most significantly, Clarence Thomas. I think the number is up to like $4 million in gifts that Clarence Thomas has received.
And failed to disclose. I mean, it's not just the receipt of gift. I just forgot to put that on my disclosure form.
And even when it was brought to his attention with ProPublica's reporting that he hadn't reported the gifts that ProPublica found out about, he still didn't report some that they hadn't found out about it until they ultimately did.
Right. When you're called on it, you might want to do, you know, a detailed review of your disclosure statements and make sure that they are indeed complete before you put on the airs of righteous indignation. Why does that matter to an average Wisconsinite or American?
Well, the Supreme Court is making some very important decisions that involve the interests of these same billionaires who and the interests of Leonard Leo going forward. So you have a tax case like the Moore case come before the Supreme Court, and the outcome of the decision itself could preempt some of the proposals that have been floated in Congress to tax these billionaires more substantially.
Which is so important. And yet the Moore case seems to open up this potential Pandora's box of tax dodging. Scott, let me ask you this. We've been talking about, you know, that there is a level of wealth where too much is just simply too much. We've talked with other experts, including yourself in this very segment, about how this ultra enormous wealth is actually fairly anti-democratic, because once you've bought your 100th Rolls Royce and your, you know, 1,000th vacation home, or your, you know, the next huge diamond for your jewelry collection, the next Rolex, money actually has this bizarre sort of diminishing marginal return at the very, very ultra wealthy levels, which you've defined as folks with a net worth of over $30 million. And what you're left with after you've acquired these billions or hundreds of millions of dollars is the idea that, well, I've got all this money. I might as well get myself some access. And by access, they mean access to the levers of power in government. That is not one person, one vote, right? And here we see this corruption playing out in a very direct way at the Supreme Court. With your work with the Excessive Wealth Institute, are you at all surprised to see this? Is the directness of it a little surprising? Because I have to tell you, I was pretty shocked when that first ProPublica report dropped this past March. I thought, wow, you didn't even try to hide it.
Absolutely. So I'm not at all surprised. I think the important thing is people are starting to see what's happening. One of our colleagues, Chuck Collins, runs an organization called inequality.org, and he's written a lot about the wealth defense industry. This is not an accident, right? Folks know exactly what they're doing, and they work very, very hard, first of all, to acquire wealth, to hoard it and conceal it and defend it, and then to use it to gather more power and more wealth. And so it's very intentional, very systematic. And I think a lot of what I'm trying to focus on, and Excessive Wealth Disorder Institute is trying to talk about as well, is to help people become aware of what's happening. Because we need to understand this is what's happening. And there's a part which is we read the news clips and people have billions of dollars and it doesn't seem to resonate. And so helping people understand how much wealth that is, stopping and asking how much is enough, and then saying, wait a minute, if people have too much, as you say, they can't really buy more things that make their lives better. Money just becomes a way of executing power and using it to influence their lives and ours. And we all need to decide whether we're okay with that.
Yeah, that fundamental idea, are we okay with certain extraordinarily wealthy people having unique and basically covered up access to our elected officials and government? And in the, as a lawyer, I'm so disgusted by this direct corruption of the Supreme Court. And I just wanted to ask you, Bob, this isn't just the Moore case, though I want to ask you a couple more questions about that particular case. This kind of corruption is also seeping in through law schools and speaker gigs and the, I forget what the actual name is, but it's like the Supreme Court Historical Society that was newly created, alleged to be sort of the brainchild also of Leonard Leo, taking in millions of dollars. There's this whole kind of racket set up to provide donors and those that help stand up these new law schools or these new chairs within law schools, access to these judges. And I don't just mean indirect access and a wink, wink, nudge, nudge. I mean, they're literally rubbing elbows at cocktail parties.
That's true. They're also creating a pipeline of judges who are predisposed to rule the way they want them to rule. You have a handful of judges, justices on the circuit courts and the Supreme Court who hire clerks. And it's a very prestigious position. And once you've been in that position, it's not the pathway is cleared to go out perhaps into the private sector for 5 or 10 years, perhaps, in government, like at Department of Justice, but then ultimately return to the court as a judge or ultimately a Supreme Court justice. And they don't have to lobby those judges and justices anymore because they're brethren at that point.
Yeah, they've been locked in. They've been literally bred to do this dirty work for what is the modern American oligarchy. Small tangent of a story, gentlemen. I myself was a federal appeals court clerk. I was considered for a fellowship in the Solicitor General's office. I was also considered for a Supreme Court clerkship. I didn't go to Yale, right? And so the more liberal leading justices were like, who's this chick that went to the University of Wisconsin that wasn't our pipeline? And I got heavily vetted by the conservatives, and there was a Republican appointee running the SG's office at the time. So my name got quickly like crossed off the list, but it was very interesting to see some of my colleagues, whom will remain nameless, go through this exact vetting process that you're discussing. This is not sort of Bob, Scott, and I hypothesizing here. I know people who have are literally in this pipeline, who are Federalist Society members and have been vetted, trained, and are ready to be dispatched should Donald Trump win another election. Before we go to break, set up exactly what was the issue in Moore v. United States, Bob, and what the case seemed to be about. And then after break, we'll talk about what it really is about. What did the case seemingly, was it about?
Sure. On the surface, the case was about a relatively obscure tax that came about in the 2017 Tax Act called the Mandatory Repatriation Tax, which was a tax on individual shareholders of a significant amount, over 10% of the stock of foreign corporations. And it was basically a transition rule to go from a system where ultimately the income of those corporations would be taxable to their U.S. shareholders to where it wouldn't be. And they needed a tax that would basically reach the earnings up to the end of 2017. And that's what the case was about, the constitutionality of this mandatory repatriation tax.
Today, I've got special guest Bob Lohr, Senior VP for Tax Policy at the Patriotic Millionaires, and our friend Scott Ellis, one of the founding board members of the Excessive Wealth Disorder Institute and a Patriotic Millionaire himself. We've been talking about corruption at the Supreme Court and how through a series of cases, especially one in this past term, Moore v. United States, the court has been not so subtly, if you're into the weeds of legal jargon and Supreme Court cases, not so subtly shifting things to benefit billionaires and ultra millionaires. We've been talking about the details behind the case Moore v. United States, which seemed to be simply about repatriation relating to folks that owned stock or were shareholders of more than 10% of foreign-based corporations. But Bob, you were explaining before the break, that's not really what the case was about. Tell us more.
Sure, it wasn't about that at all. What it really was about are the arguments that were made to say that this mandatory repatriation tax was unconstitutional. And there were basically two of them. One is that because the earnings were not actually being distributed, the taxation of the earnings was the equivalent of taxing the wealth of these shareholders. And therefore, if it's a wealth tax, it is something called a direct tax, which under the Constitution is very hard to make constitutional. So the upshot of that argument is wealth taxes are unconstitutional. The second argument is that because the earnings hadn't been distributed, the income had not been realized by these shareholders. And the 16th Amendment, which provides for the income tax, only applies to realized income, not unrealized income. So those were, and what the intent was to win on either or both of these arguments and create a situation where current tax proposals, such as Elizabeth Warren's ultra-millionaires tax, which is a tax on wealth, or President Biden's billionaire minimum income tax, which is effectively, which arguably is a tax on unrealized gains, render those unconstitutional preemptively. That was the intention. What actually happened was the majority of the justices found a way to say that the mandatory repatriation tax was constitutional without officially reaching any of those arguments. But the opinions make clear that four of the nine justices are ready to go for the billionaires and rule both wealth taxes and taxes on unrealized gains are unconstitutional. And Brett Kavanaugh's, in his opinion, suggested very, very strongly that he would rule wealth taxes are unconstitutional, and there's a pretty decent chance would also find a way to say that taxes on unrealized gains are unconstitutional. And by the way, by unrealized gains, we're talking about someone who bought Amazon for $1 a share and it's now worth $500 a share, and they're not paying tax simply because they haven't sold the Amazon stock yet.
But it, of course, allows them to borrow against that at infinitesimal interest rates. There's all sorts of gamesmanship. We've talked about so very much of that on the show. Would I be incorrect in hazarding a guess that in addition to Brett Kavanaugh, we absolutely have Justices Thomas and Alito also siding on the side of, oh, it's unconstitutional to tax wealth or unrealized income?
Well, the four that are, that I'd say are kind of in the bag for the billionaires are Thomas, Gorsuch, Alito, and Coney Barrett.
Very interesting. I would have generally thought of Kavanaugh in the bag as well, simply because of his, again, I'll call it grooming over many decades. He is one of those good old boys from the Federalist Society. Scott, when we look at this, and you and I have talked about potential policy options, when we look at these people that have wealth that basically has exceeded their ability to ever spend it, has exceeded the needs of even generations of their family. Again, wealth, we're talking extreme and extraordinary multitudes of millions, if not billions of dollars. When you hear these arguments about the constitutionality and we're looking at the makeup of the court, how important is this next presidential election and simply the idea of economic fairness to those that work for paychecks and wages here in the United States?
I mean, it's critically important. I mean, this is the mechanism through which individuals are appointed to the Supreme Court, which then becomes a vehicle for implementing policies like this to enable the excessively wealthy to gather wealth, to protect it, and to increase that wealth and then use it. And so this is what it's about. And at some level you'd say, we are in a democracy. The most important thing that we as citizens have is the vote, and we need to use it. And at some point I'd say, listening to Bob, make no mistake, there is a reason these people are doing what they're doing. They know that the solution to this problem is tax policy. They do not want to let us use it. And I think we all need to realize what's happening. We can try and play whack-a-mole and try and address corporate compensation committees, and then we'll try and deal with the climate change thing over here and address wealth over there. Ultimately, government is good at certain things. One of the things governments can do is collect taxes. This is a very straightforward way of thinking about the world, and it's critically important. Citizens need to be aware of the problem, understand how important it is, and see that the role that we all have is to vote to try and make the change we need.
We can look back to Citizens United, where money was declared to be equivalent to speech. And what I say to everyone listening out there, based on what Bob Lord has shared with us, the Senior Vice President for Tax Policy at Patriotic Millionaires, what Scott Ellis has shared with us, one of the founding board members of the Excessive Wealth Disorder Institute, a rich guy himself and a patriotic millionaire, is this. If billionaires get to scream at policymakers because money is speech, the only solution that you and I have, the regular people, working people, is that we need to gather our voices together, $1 and one vote at a time, if you will, and send an unequivocally clear message that we want a fair tax system. We want the richest corporations and the richest Americans to pay their fair share. We have had enough.
Thanks for listening to Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money, a joint production of Civic Media and the Patriotic Millionaires. For more information, go to patrioticmillionaires.org and be sure to tell your friends. The Patriotic Millionaires buy advertising across a number of Civic Media stations.